Sirocco by Andrew Wood and Alastair Morton. Disc 5. Listen, Jack, you don't have the authority here. You have to report to me on this. Governor Russell tried meekly to regain some authority in the situation, but it was too late. He'd exposed his indecisiveness and his lack of forethought for all to see, and Jack wasn't willing to accommodate him. Now listen, Walter, we don't have time here to bullshit around with whether you think you're getting your fair share of responsibilities, okay? The governor tried to reply, but Jack cut him off before he could even get out a word. This woman, Sabina, is running around the country blowing up buildings, so just do as I say and keep your political bitching for someone else. Director Spelling stepped between the two, because for a split second he thought they were going to come to blows. But for all Jack's fire and roughness, there was one thing he wasn't. And that was out of control. No matter what his thoughts of Russell were, he wasn't going to be drawn into a dispute like that. There were more urgent things to deal with, and he wasn't going to waste energy on a scheming pawn like him. Governor Russell backed down almost immediately, as Jack knew he would, and he marched off down the corridor to inform his team. But as soon as Russell was gone, Spelling weighed in with an angle of his own.
Listen, Jack, you may be in charge out there in the field, Spelling began. But you made me look like a fool in front of the president. Now, I'm not going to stand for that, do you hear?
Jack sensed Spelling's manipulation. I didn't have to do anything, he said. You did it to yourself. Spelling could see that Jack wasn't going to be fooled by his childish games and side-taking, and immediately changed tack, deciding a brash and brazen approach would work better. He fixed Jack with an eye-to-eye stare.
I don't want any of your bullshit here, Wildy. I know your game. I've seen it before, and I'll tell you right now, there'll be no statements from you on TV or to the press without consulting me first. Is that clear?
All I want is to catch Sabina Tlaib, Jack replied forcefully, and then you can make all the goddamn press statements you want. That doesn't concern me, just as long as they don't compromise my operation, or you will have a lot to answer for.
Are you threatening me, Wildy?
Jack retreated slightly, keen to avoid creating too much of a divide in the White House. As much as he disliked Spelling's and Russell's attitudes, he knew he needed them, and knew they had to work together if they were to have any chance of stopping Sabina. She had planted two bombs already that they knew of, but he had no way of knowing how many more she'd put in place, and he would need the director's help if they were to catch her before any more were to detonate. He assured Spelling he wouldn't do anything without at least letting him know first, but informed him in no uncertain terms that the final decision was his all the way down the line. The director agreed and set off to brief his team as well. Roy and Jack sat in the back of a blacked-out SUV, its siren blaring, and it took them straight from the south lawn of the White House to Pennsylvania Avenue. As it weaved in and out of the traffic, Jack couldn't help it, and his thoughts flooded back to Boston. If the bank, a couple of minutes away, was anything like North Station, then he could already anticipate the casualties would be catastrophic. But more worrying to him was the effect it would have on the population. By now, the whole country would know, as the cameras that surrounded the blast site fed the horrific images around the world. Singularly, these attacks were horrific. But back-to-back like this, they contained a threat that was there for the whole televised world to see. As the car sped up 15th Street, past the Hotel Washington and the Department of Treasury, Jack could see the scale of the situation he was about to step into. The black smoke billowing from what was left of the Bank of America loomed large overhead and swept down the panic-filled streets as men and women walked out into the road. The women were crying as they held their children, and men stood staring at the dark cloud above the rooftops which was moving towards them, creeping over the stone buildings and flying flags with an evil menace. Although they couldn't see where it was coming from, everybody knew. The city itself seemed to know. Cars had stopped in the street, abandoned and deserted as people panicked, and the driver had to dart in and out of them to get to the bank. As they turned into Pennsylvania Avenue, Roy and Jack could see for the first time the devastation the explosion had caused. The street was filled with debris, which stretched all the way from one side of the road to the other. Bits of stone and rock and shards of glass littered the street, and colored brick from the walls of the bank lay strewn across the road. The bomb had exploded with such force it had sent pieces of the bank's exterior walls rocketing across the street, and they'd become embedded in the fronts of the opposing shops and stores. One of the streetlights lining the walkway had been uprooted from its base and had collapsed over the road and onto a public bus, which was now pinned to the road as the long metal neck of the light had wrapped itself around its roof. The traffic in the street had stood fender to fender, as it would in any rush hour, the difference this time being that each car was empty as the occupants had fled. The vehicles that had been in front of the bank at the time of the detonation bore the marks of a formidable force. Their windows had imploded, lacerating those within, whom Jack could see were now sat on the sidewalk, waiting for medical attention to arrive. The car that had been closest to the bank, a blue Lexus saloon, had been thrown into the air and had come to rest on the back of the car in front, its hood resting on the rear fender. The bank itself seemed to have imploded, as if it had been hollowed out and had crumpled from the inside, caving in upon itself. The internal floors had taken the full brunt of the explosion and had largely disintegrated, crumbling away from existence. But a maze of interior walls had survived, and dotted in amongst this, the cashier desk stood proud and defensive across the floor of the concourse. Among the yells and screams, the parasitic news crews went about their work, shining a camera in the faces of the blast victims and bombarding them with questions without once offering a hand of help. Somehow, they were always there first, as if there was a reporter on the corner of every street of every town just waiting for their big scoop. As Jack and Roy pulled up as close to the bank as they could get, two ambulances raced around the corner and pulled up next to them, their crews jumping out and springing into action to help the wounded. Local cops had sealed the road off, but they were as shocked at what had taken place as the injured people in front of them. They tried to wrestle some control from the situation as best they could, but it was not long before the FBI and Homeland Security arrived, much to the relief of the stunned and strained police force. As the uniformed officers patrolled the cordoned-off ends of the road, a mass of onlookers steadily grew as people from surrounding streets congregated to see the fate that had befallen their town, and they stood horror-struck, gazing at the wreckage that remained. A woman staggered from the wreckage of the bus, screaming as she wept,
"Why do they hate us? Why?"
As she stumbled through the debris, a paramedic grabbed her and wrapped her in a blanket, but her screams and wails could be heard the street long. Her agonized calls for explanation were not only her thoughts, though, and as she was led off, her words echoed throughout the street. Not reverberating off the walls and the man-made stone creations, but off something less ephemeral, something that was less tangible but unmistakably far more real. As the crowd of onlookers swelled, her words bounced from one person to the next, from one person's consciousness to another, in a collective outpouring of grief and defenselessness. Jack and Roy got out of the car and rushed towards the bank, stooping under the police tape as they entered. The air was heavy with dust still, and Roy was forced to take a handkerchief from his pocket and cover his mouth, gagging as he did so. But Jack just marched on, unaffected.
"Hey, you, agent, what's the deal here?"
Jack asked, summoning an unnamed FBI agent who was stood at the front of what had been the bank.
"I don't know, sir. There doesn't seem to be anyone left inside. No one has come out, and our teams haven't found anyone yet." "Well, do we have a count on how many people were in the bank prior to detonation?" "I don't know, sir. It all happened so fast."
As the agent fumbled for words, his superior came over, keen to ensure the scene was secure.
"Hey there, this is a restricted crime scene. You can't be back here."
Jack quickly explained, flashing his ID and introducing himself and Roy, and the FBI agent calmed down.
"Sorry, sir. I thought you were the press trying to get photos. You know what they're like. As far as we can tell, the bomb detonated somewhere inside the bank. We know that for sure, but it's going to take a bit of time. From the shape of the blast, we think it originated in the basement. That's where the device must have been." "The basement? You think it was an inside job?"
Jack pricked up at the thought of having a cold, hard lead he could follow. An inside job would have meant an employee, and they would have records.
"No, not an employee, sir. Not as far as we can tell." Well, what's in the basement, then? It's the safety deposit vault. And other than the attendants working there, the only people who have access are customers that have rented a box. But the security's watertight. Better than at the airport, sir. Nobody could have got anything down there. Well, it appears that someone has. I want to get a list of all the employees of the bank. But, sir, with respect, nobody made it out of there. They're all dead. I don't care. I want the list. Maybe someone didn't come into work today. And I want a list of everyone who had a deposit box there, too. Telling from Jack's tone that it wasn't a time to question, the FBI agent scampered off, passing on the orders to his men, who set about searching for the records.
Hey, ease up, Jack. He's only doing his job.
Roy tried to intervene, but Jack didn't reply, or even turn around. He stood staring at the smoky remains of the building, as if he was trying to work something out, as if he was waiting for the answer to show itself and come walking out of the flames of its own accord. It was the second time inside of a week he had stood like that on his own soil. The second time he had stood staring as lifeless bodies were carried out of a building and as blood-covered people populated the public streets. It was a sight he knew only too well, but one you never get accustomed to. And in that moment, the numbness Jack had grown used to feeling was invaded by a solitary pang of fear. Only for a moment did he feel it and allow it to pervade his body. But in that moment, he wondered to himself how many more times he was going to have to see it. Behind Jack, Roy was talking to Director Spelling, who'd finally arrived on the scene. Spelling wanted to know the figures, how many and where, and Jack could hear his questions, but he didn't let on. He just stood and listened as Spelling poked and prodded for information. But in all the questions he asked, Jack didn't once hear him ask what he could do to help. Jack didn't know if this was because he was just working the PR angle, getting his facts right, and then picking his tie so he was ready for the cameras, or whether it was just his belligerence and his way of showing he wasn't going to take orders. Either way, it just proved all Jack's opinions of the man were spot on. As Roy dealt with him and kept him at bay, Jack followed one of the ambulance crews into the bank. Inside, it was dark and claustrophobic. The smell of blood was noxious, and the dampness it brought was all too palpable. And Jack immediately felt as if the walls were caving in, not collapsing suddenly and giving way to the weights they were struggling to support, but just moving in slowly, inch by inch, as if to remain unnoticed, strangling the air out of the building and suffocating the men inside. The paramedic teams felt their way through the darkness, shielding their mouths and gently moving into the black one step at a time, waiting for the softness underfoot of a human body. Jack followed behind, one hand held over his mouth, the other arched out in front of his head to shield it from any overhanging objects just waiting to strike. Water poured down from a ruptured overhead pipe, drenching all those who ventured inside, and the debris lay thick on the ground, several feet deep, to the point where it was impossible to see the floor. It was impossible to tell who could be buried underneath. He tried to search, but in the mess and the dark, it was a fruitless endeavor. In front of him, he could hear the shouts from the paramedics who'd found someone, and he rushed forward to do what little he could to help. As one of the team swung his flashlight round to light Jack's way, he briefly glimpsed the true extent of the damage, as its small tungsten bulb threw flickers of light across the room. The far wall was gone, but what was behind it, Jack couldn't make out. Across the floor, or rather across what the floor was now covered with, he could see the bodies of the people unlucky enough to have been going about their business at the wrong time. A woman's corpse lay hunched across a large sheet of metal that had formed part of the understructure of one of the walls. Its hulking frame, an inch and a half thick, torn from its foundations. Through the barely glimpsed wreckage, Jack could see many more bodies, or at least parts of bodies, limbs and necks protruding unnaturally from the rubble, their bent and snapped and half-crushed forms holding no chance of life. As he neared the team, he could see the body of a woman in her early to mid-40s who was most definitely alive. She'd suffered some major trauma, and could not move, but she was breathing and conscious, which was a miracle in itself. The paramedics immediately knew what to do, giving her a syringe of morphine and wrapping her fragile neck in a brace before hoisting her body onto a stretcher. As they pulled her body from the rock and stone, it suddenly became apparent the extent of her injuries that had until then remained largely concealed. All of a sudden, blood shot out, gushing upwards and spraying one of the paramedics. The blood ran dark over his face as the limited light from the three flashlights illuminated the woman's body. "Please, sir, put pressure here!" And he took Jack's hand and held it firmly over a large gash in the woman's torso. Stretching over her hip and into her pelvis, the wound was deep. Caused by a part of the roof that had fallen down on her, the rock had sealed the wound somewhat when it had lain on top of her. But now her body had been removed. It was open and exposed, and the blood ran freely. Jack pressed down as hard as he could, and he could feel the woman's faint pulse through the palm of his hand. The paramedic twisted a makeshift bandage over the gash, and once it was secured, they began getting her out. The dust and debris wasn't doing her any good, obstructing her breathing and poisoning the wound, and she had to be removed immediately. Jack picked up one end of the stretcher and lifted it, his handkerchief over his mouth dropping to the floor, and together with one of the medics, he carried her out of the decaying building. As they neared the light at the front of the building, Jack began coughing as the inhaled smoke caught in his lungs, and as he approached the exit point, he turned round and glimpsed the other three medics as they made their way further into the smoldering building, driven by the hunt to find someone else alive. Outside, Jack coughed and spluttered his way free. In what had been only a few minutes, he'd been soaked from head to foot, and he was covered completely in black soot. Such was the intensity of the smoke inside. But despite this, it now seemed as if the inside of the building was the quieter and more rational place. Outside, the street was filled with roaring sirens and flashing lights from one end of the street to the other. TV crews had descended in their droves, almost cordoning off the street all by their own, and news reporters fussed about while assistants combed their hair and splashed their face with makeup, ready to go in front of the camera. Medics hurried around, seeing to the injured, bandaging wounds of those fortunate enough to have been far enough away down the street to escape with their lives. But not many were that fortunate. The criticals had long since departed for George Washington University Hospital, or for Providence, airlifted right out from the street, the whirring blades covering all those below in a swirling wave of dust and debris as the firefighters stepped in to secure the safety of the building. It had been damaged beyond repair, but before the rescue services committed any more people, they had to ensure that the building was structurally sound. Jack stood in the center of the street, watching as everything sped around him, and for the first time, he felt the years catching up on him. His chest thumped as he struggled to catch his breath, his lungs tightening as they struggled to eject the poisons within. The smoke had gone deep, and his throat clenched painfully with each attempt to claw a little bit of air back. He'd only been inside for a matter of minutes, but his body was suffering, and he thought to himself, "I'm getting too old for this shit." He stood amongst the noise and catastrophe and looked around. The FBI and Homeland Security stayed back, observing from a safe distance with their superiors, and Director Spelling could clearly be seen numbered amongst them. As their coats and ties blew in the commotion and they talked incessantly into their phones, the true men of the hour set about their jobs and about helping some real people. The medics were treating the wounded, as three more search teams were preparing to enter the building. The fire department were yet to issue a statement on the building's structure, but the teams knew that time was not on their side, and that it would be down to their selflessness and courage if anyone was to have a chance of coming out alive. With little thought for themselves or for their loved ones, they suited up, strapped the breathing equipment to their backs, and bravely entered the carnage of the bomb-damaged building. Then, suddenly, through the deafening noise and the relentless motion, Roy came striding purposefully up to Jack, clutching a small phone protectively in his hand.
"Jack, it's the White House. Those files you gave the translators. Well, they've found something."
Chapter 20. Jack and Roy climbed back in the SUV, joined by Governor Russell, and the driver hurtled back to the White House, leaving the emergency team searching through the smoldering remains of the bank for survivors. The car pulled up through the south gate and drove up to the west wing where the president was waiting. As they hurried inside, Jack could sense something had happened. Members of the Homeland Security were running to and fro, frantically carrying sheets of paper and talking into their cell phones. And the vice president was present, having rushed back to Washington from an out-of-town engagement. The Oval Office was a blur of activity. The president sat down at his desk, talking to two of the translators Wise had given Suleiman's files to. They sat, clutching a handful of documents between them, and looked up at Jack, Roy, and Governor Russell, who entered the room.
"Sit down, please, gentlemen," the president said. "You'll need to hear this."
Roy and Governor Russell sat down, but Jack remained standing.
"If you don't mind, Mr. President, I'd rather stand, as you can see I'm a total mess."
The president agreed, and then turned to his senior translator.
"Now, Mr. Fidesco, I want you to tell him exactly what you told me."
Tommy Fidesco was a New Yorker of Italian descent. He was dressed in a designer suit, and he spoke sharply, although his European heritage was all but lost, buried somewhere beneath his thick East Coast twang.
"Yes, sir," he said, turning to Jack. "Well, we were translating the files, as Mr. Wise had instructed, and most of it was nonsensical. It had been written in code, or at least in a format that we couldn't decipher. Now, we could break the code, but it would take some time. But not all of the pages were written in this code. Some of them contained handwritten sections, and these were just in plain Arabic. Now, we've translated these as best we could, and this is where it goes a bit gray, as not all of it translates precisely. And without knowing its context, it's impossible to make a 100% accurate translation, but amongst the pages, there is what appears to be a residential address."
"Son of a bitch! Where?" Jack cried.
"It's an address in Miami, sir, downtown, towards the Glades."
"Mr. President, I'd bet $1,000 that this is an address the bomber has used, and my guess is Sabina Talib is there, or if not, then she's definitely been there in the last few days."
$1,000, Jack," smiled the president. "I think we're paying the SIS too much these days."
"Not so, Mr. President, I can assure you of that, not at all. But I think we should get down there and take a look at this location. Even if she skipped town, there's a chance we could still turn up something new, sir."
The president agreed.
"Was there anything else in there, Mr. Fidesco?" Jack asked. Tommy explained how most of the files had contained small plans and maps, but unless they knew where they were of little use. But Jack took the translated pages anyway, hoping that somewhere along the line their locations would become known. The two hand-drawn but highly detailed schematics were no doubt detailing particular buildings that Sabina was going to hit, but it was impossible to find out where. Even if they were buildings in one of the cities on the list, attempting to discover it would be an impossible task. There were 8 cities left on the list after the attacks in Boston and Washington, but there was no way of knowing if these plans were even in those cities. For all Jack and his team knew, they could have been of buildings anywhere in the country, or back in Switzerland even, and their hand-drawn nature meant that they could not be checked against any existing records. Suleiman had been careful. Also detailed in the translated pages were lists of equipment, plastic explosive, handguns and semi-automatics, and recipes for making small impromptu explosives, a throwback Jack could see to Suleiman's days in the Middle East. Jack listened intently as Tommy Fidesco carried on, explaining as much as he could what he'd found in the pages. But other than the single address scrawled across one of the pages, there was little for them to go on. And he spoke almost apologetically, disappointed he couldn't report back with any greater news. But to Jack, this provided a much-needed lifeline. And as soon as the president gave the go-ahead, he wanted to be on his way to Miami.
"Jack, what do you think?"
"Mr. President, I think we need to move on this location as soon as possible."
"So do I, Jack," the president agreed.
"With your permission, I don't think we should do this lightly. If she's there or not, either way, she's going to be prepared. I'd like to order the house to be kept under surveillance until I get there. The element of surprise is the key here, sir."
The president nodded, and as quickly as they had begun, he disbanded the meeting. Tommy Fidesco and his colleague, who'd not said a word, exited the Oval Office. Jack turned to Governor Russell, who had long since succumbed to the fact that the situation was far out of his control, and he listened attentively as Jack laid out what was going to happen. Russell left soon after to inform his men and to contact Director Spelling, and only then did Jack turn to the president.
"Mr. President, sir, I want Fidesco and his team to keep working on the files, see what they can turn up. But this needs to be said, sir. You need to be fully aware of the situation at hand. Suleiman and his bomber have planned this operation meticulously. There are going to be more bombs, sir. It's unavoidable. In my opinion, she will have worked the East Coast and moved on a long time ago. She will already have planted more bombs, and unless we find her, they're going to detonate."
"Jesus, Jack."
"What we need to do now is advise all the banks of what has happened here. We need to get the word out to all the branches across the country to be on the lookout for a young woman looking to rent a deposit box. But we have to keep it quiet. If the media catch wind of it, then there's every chance she'll change her targets to something else. But for the time being, she'll stick to her plan as it's working. Our best bet is to track her down before she plants any more. That's our only chance here. And then maybe she'll give up their locations. But only maybe. The point is, sir, we need to stop her planting any more. And we'll only be able to do that when we've caught her, because we can't do anything about what she's done already."
The president listened to Jack, taking in each word carefully, only now realizing the scale of the threat that the nation faced. Roy stood silently in the room, listening too. And when the president had given the order, he and Jack left immediately for the airport. As they drove through the city streets to the CIA hangar at Dulles International, they both sat silent in the back of the car, each considering what they would find in Miami. Governor Russell had contacted Spelling at the bank, and he was going to meet them at the plane and fly with them. By the time they reached him, he'd already informed the Bureau in the South, and they would have a team ready for when they landed. Although Roy was hopeful they'd find something, Jack was less optimistic. Looking over the pages on Sabina Talib again, he now felt that he knew her. He felt that she was someone he understood. And his experience told him she wouldn't be there. And if the precision of the attack so far was any gauge of how meticulously she was carrying out the operation, then who knows what they would find. But to Jack, one thing was for sure, and that was that they had to be careful. Anything they could have thought of, she was sure to have thought of herself already. 20 minutes later, they'd boarded a CIA jet and were airborne, flying southeast over the city towards Miami. As Jack, Roy, and Spelling sat in the single-engine 20-seater, they turned on the TV to see exactly what was going on. How the press were handling the situation and what they were reporting was of paramount importance to Jack, as he knew that somewhere out there, Sabina would be watching it too. Jack turned on each of the three screens and turned them to four different channels, CNN, ABC, CBS, and Fox. All four of the stations were filled with the same images, a tanned and hairsprayed 20-something standing on Pennsylvania Avenue, the bank in the background, clutching a microphone and spouting the kind of perpetual speculation and hearsay that Jack couldn't stand.
"Alan, there's no word yet what caused the explosion, yet unconfirmed reports suggest that it was an explosive device planted inside the bank. The authorities have not released any numbers yet on the casualties, but judging from the size of the blast you can see behind me here and the time of day, we have to assume the numbers to be high, perhaps 40 or 50 people."
"Thanks, Tina," the studio newscaster responded. "Now, is there any word from the authorities on who planted the device, if indeed that is what it turns out to be?"
"No, Alan. The police and security forces are keeping it close to their chest at this point in time and aren't releasing any information. But suffice it to say that Pennsylvania Avenue and the entirety of Capitol Hill have been shut down, and what appears to be the CIA are now in charge, although that is unconfirmed."
"If the CIA are involved, does that suggest this is a more serious issue then, Tina, and one that is being looked at the highest level?"
"Well, that's right, Alan, yes. If this is the CIA who are in control here, then we have to assume that the explosion was intended and that someone is responsible. The immediate question has to be whether this was a terrorist act, and I think at present it is safe to assume that that is the case."
The reporter continued her brief to camera, and the studio newsreader listened, the most concerned-looking expression he could muster seemingly attached indelibly to his face. Jack, Roy, and Spelling watched as the four channels each reported in their own manner the same lack of information between them. Jack was angered, but not altogether surprised at the spin the media managed to create in such a short period of time. No statement had been made to the press, as Jack had instructed, hoping that it would make Sabina think they had no idea who was behind it. But simultaneously, he knew that was a risk. Their lack of statement could be interpreted differently by her, and it was a gamble, whichever way they chose to play it. If they said nothing, it would look like they had no information, like they had not found Suleiman, or even knew he was behind it. But it could look like they were keeping something from the media, and if this was what Sabina thought, it could scare her off. It was a no-win situation, and Jack knew it, and he felt the best choice of action was to say nothing. At least that way they kept all their cards in their hands. They had more options open to them that way. Back on the screen, the various channels had entered their repeat zone, where they had no new information to report, so they just repeated the same thing over and over again, punctuating it with as many commentators and experts as they could drum up at short notice.
Good afternoon. If you are just joining us, we have this breaking news. This morning at 11 a.m., there was an explosion at a bank on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. We bring you now live pictures from the Capitol, where our reporter David Lavender is on the scene. David, what are the latest developments?
Well, there is no official statement yet, but I can confirm that Senator Al Young from Vermont was in the bank when the explosion took place, and that he was one of what is estimated to be 40 customers in the bank at that time.
Now, that is a high figure. How has that been confirmed there on the ground?
Well, literally moments ago, I spoke to a member of the senator's staff who was waiting in the senator's car, which was parked right here on Pennsylvania Avenue. It couldn't have been more than about 60 yards from the bank when the explosion happened. He told me that the senator had gone into the bank 2 or 3 minutes before the explosion took place and that he did not leave. He is still waiting for any information. Now, a number of bodies have been removed from the bank already, but as far as we can see, no one has been found alive. And so I'm afraid it does not look good.
Can you tell us approximately how many casualties have been removed so far?
At the moment, it's hard to say. There's no official word, but 7 or 8 bodies have been removed, and as you can see behind me, the damage to the bank is extensive, and it doesn't bode well for finding anyone alive inside.
Yes, we can see that the bank is very badly damaged. Was there any warning given?
No, there wasn't, and so far no one has stepped forward to claim responsibility, if indeed it was a terrorist attack.
CNN cut back to the worried-looking newsreader, who immediately turned to their counterterrorism expert in the studio. The majority of the other channels had yet to decide and report that the explosion was a terrorist action, but CNN had decided that no such thought or restraint was needed, and plowed on irrespectively, drawing September 11th comparisons almost immediately. But what surprised Jack was the stance they took. Linking the explosion to Boston seemed to take longer than aligning it with 9/11. And the only reason Jack could conceive was that Boston was a public place. Bombing a public train station was obviously less important and less of a threat than bombing the Capitol or a business and capitalist institution like the World Trade Center. Or perhaps it was just less sensational and harder to draw their analogies. Either way, Jack was disgusted, and he turned the screens off. He turned to Roy and Spelling and began explaining what he wanted to happen in Miami. He wanted to raid the address the translators had discovered, but he wanted to keep it as low-key as possible. The assault on Suleiman was still strong in his mind, and he didn't want to make the same mistakes. He wanted 4 men from the bureau on it, and no more, he explained to Spelling. 2 would secure the rear of the building, with 1 man taking position on each side. He would approach the front himself, posing as a member of the public or salesman, and he would make the contact. He knew he had to go first, because all they had to go on was an address. They had no idea who was there. The Miami authorities had reported the premises as under tenancy. Although this seemed suspicious to Jack, he knew it could just as easily mean nothing. For all they knew, the door could open to anyone. A family of 4 newly moved in, or builders or contractors carrying out maintenance. The building was listed with a rental company in the city, who said it had been rented out under the name of Grant for the past 3 months. But they had had no contact with the occupants. The rent had been paid up front and in full, and there was still 3 weeks to go. The address Tommy Fidesco had uncovered was 1874 Selby Boulevard in downtown Miami. It was a rough neighborhood, made up of cheap housing and rented apartments. The majority of the people who lived there were poor, the neglected and ignored blue-collar working classes, largely employed in the industrial areas of the city further south along the coast. It was a transient neighborhood. Nobody lived there for long. And if they did, it certainly wasn't out of choice. It was the kind of neighborhood where someone could remain unnoticed, and in this respect, it would have been perfect for Sabina's purposes. Jack had decided to check up on the news coverage again, and the four screens were broadcasting their identical reporters standing in front of identical images when the satellite phone on the cabin wall burst into life. Roy answered it first, speaking quickly into the receiver before passing it to Jack.
Jack, it's Don here. Listen, you aren't going to believe this. There's been another explosion, this time in a bank in Miami.
Although the news had come sooner than he'd expected, it wasn't of any surprise, and Jack had been anticipating the call.
God damn it, he said,
but with more a tone of acceptance rather than shock or astonishment.
Tell me, how bad is it?
On the other end of the call, Don relayed the reports he had at that point in time that an explosion had occurred at a branch of the Bank of America in Miami at 150 West Wagler Street. It had been a big explosion in a busy and built-up area, and the death toll was expected to be high.
It's the same M.O. as Washington and Boston, Jack.
Jack listened as Roy gave him the details, before informing him he was on his way to Miami as they spoke. He would go to the bank, but he already knew what to expect. The blood, the bodies, the screams, and the smoke. It had all happened again, and he was powerless to do anything about it. The only thing he could do was to get to this address downtown and turn it inside out. He could get lucky and get a break, bringing Sabina closer to his grasp. Jack hung up the receiver and turned to convey the news to Roy and Spelling. But he didn't have to say a word. It was already on their screens. The identikit images they'd seen all too often over the previous few days. The sirens, the smoking buildings and rubble-filled streets had been brought to the United States once again. As Jack flicked from channel to channel, he could see they were all filled with the same images, each channel abandoning their programming to bring the most up-to-date footage they could. In amongst shots of the two banks, the networks cut to clips of the bombing shown by foreign news networks and TV stations around the world. As the newsreaders in New York and Washington struggled to maintain their composure as the news filtered through and they announced it to the world, the look of terror and incredulity became all too visible on their shocked faces. As they read their auto cues as best they could in between cutting to the reporters and standing in front of yet another flaming city street, it was the words that scrolled over the bottom of the screen that caught the eye and would be read by countless millions of people. It was only three words, numbering six syllables among their triumvirate, but they encapsulated the moment so succinctly and incisively that nobody could mistake or debate them. As the TV stations' newsrooms broadcast their speculation and conjecture, these three words and the images they were superimposed upon made it unnecessary for them to speak at all. And they said it all better than any copywriter could. America under attack. Chapter 21. It was too late now, and there was no going back. A statement could not be postponed any longer. But rather than making a statement to the press by the FBI or CIA or even Homeland Security, it was now going to have to come from the president. He was going to have to address the nation and calm their fears. But that was an issue for Washington, and at that point, Jack wasn't part of that. He had to deal with Miami. As soon as they landed, a chopper picked them up and flew them over the city. As they flew south over the city from the northern tip of its metropolitan area, climbing high over the Miami skyline, a thin line of black smoke pumped into the screaming blue sky, and the location of the bank was clear. West Wagler Street ran through the center of the city, from east to west, and the Bank of America branch was situated about two-thirds of the length along, at the coast end. As Jack peered out over the central area of the city, Miami Beach was clearly visible on his right. Six cruise ships sat in the causeway, docked at the port of Miami, and the huge hotels towered along the coast, stretching high into the air and being by far the tallest buildings on the east of the city. Next to this ran a succession of expensive waterside homes, each one larger than the one next to it, sprawling around the harbor in their quest for dominance, each with their own individually designed characteristics. As the plumes of smoke drew closer, the helicopter descended so Jack could get as close a view of the bank as possible. As he leaned over and peered out through the curved glass of the front canopy, he could see what was left of the building. Jack could tell from the shape and trajectory of the blast that the device must have been placed towards the rear of the building and down low, perhaps on a basement floor. The explosion had ripped through the roof of the bank and demolished the rear walls rather than the front this time, and the street looked unaffected. But the damage inside more than made up for this lack of forethought on behalf of the bomber. The Bank of America branch on this street in Miami was an older building than its counterpart in the Capitol. Where the Washington building in large parts had withstood the force of the explosion, in Miami it had crumbled in on itself. The blast radius was less here, but the sheer extent of the destruction within meant that, and Jack could see it instantly, it would be unlikely that there were any survivors.
"Let's set this bird down, okay? Make sure you men are ready, Spilling." Jack barked his orders, shouting to be heard over the noise of the engine above, and Spilling picked up the radio mic and called ahead. Four of his men, as he had instructed, were indeed waiting at the police precinct in Little Haiti, and they would touch down on its helipad in 3 minutes. When they landed, and once Jack had explained the situation and how the raid would go down, they made their way to the garage and into their cars, leaving Roy behind to check on the situation at the bank. The address was only 10 minutes away. As they drove through the city streets, Jack put on a flak jacket and strapped it tightly about his chest as the four FBI agents did the same. He put his shirt back on over the top and placed a full clip into the base of his Browning pistol. As they pulled up through the neighborhood, Jack felt an adrenaline rush again. He was apprehensive, not for his own safety, but for those of the men who were counting on him. They'd been informed they were to arrest anyone found in the building and had been briefed as to the nature of who they might find. But they were young guys, two of them under 35 for sure, and the last thing Jack wanted was any of them to take a bullet. Too much blood had been spilt that morning, and he didn't want any more to be added to it. The car parked at the end of the block, and the six men got out. Three of the FBI agents took the path at the rear that ran between the rows of houses and took their positions. The one remaining agent walked on ahead and concealed himself between the target house and the one adjacent to it and waited for Jack. Jack walked along the street, a clipboard in hand and a rucksack pulled over his left shoulder. He walked up to the house and turned onto the path that led the 12 or so feet from the sidewalk to the stoop at the front door. At the back, the first agent crept up to the back window and peered in. Inside, the room was dark and empty. A cardboard box lay against the wall to one side, but that was all. Nothing was moving. He signaled to the other man, who snuck up to the back door and gently forced it open, twisting a bladed instrument in the locking mechanism. He stepped into the musty dark, and the other agent followed, leaving one man outside as cover. As they made their way inside, checking all of the corners and listening for signs of movement, they kept radio silence. Jack rang the doorbell and moved 3 paces back so as not to appear intimidating. The two agents inside stood silent, waiting for someone to move. Suddenly, upstairs, something moved. The agents stopped in their tracks and listened. Something was definitely moving, but moving slowly. It wasn't the sound of someone walking to the door, confident with the knowledge they should be there, but of someone who was hesitant. Whoever it was did not welcome the presence at the front door and did not want to answer it. Jack pressed the buzzer, and this time they heard the noise again. Heavy footsteps charged across the second floor and down the stairs, running in their direction,
Jack shouted through the front window, asking if anyone was home, but the body inside ignored him. It ran down the stairs, which opened into the kitchen, and whoever it was bolted through the door from the kitchen into the main room where the two agents were crouched, their pistols trained on the doorway in front of them. As the door swung open, a man ran in, but before the agents could tell him to freeze, he tripped and tumbled into the room, clutching at his ankles. One of the agents leapt to his feet and pinned the man down, while the other radioed to Jack.
"It's a bomb! Just a vagrant, sir! The house is empty!"
The agent laughed and repeated his call over the radio, but as he spoke into the mic, the other agent noticed something. Across the floor, stretching from one side to the other, and no more than 3 inches off the ground, ran a thin strip of wire. The agent handcuffed the man and followed the wire, but when he moved a pile of boxes and saw where it went, it was too late. As it curled through his fingers and across the palm of his hand, he suddenly realized what it was. He dropped the wire and shouted into his mic, "Get out of here! The house is wired to blow!" and turned to the other agent. But before he could get another word out, time was up. Hearing this on his radio, Jack backed away to the sidewalk, but as he tried to contact the agents in the house, the bomb in the main room exploded. The tripwire Sabina had rigged across the floor fed into a small explosive hidden by the boxes at the side of the room. When the agent had moved them, it had armed, and seconds later, it detonated. The explosion blew out all of the windows and tore the wooden-framed house apart, belching smoke and flames into the sky. Jack was sent flying across the sidewalk, the force picking him up and tossing him into the air like a piece of meat. The agent at the side of the house picked himself up and ran around to the front of the house to check on Jack. Jack was dusting himself down as the agent ran up to him.
"You okay?"
he asked.
"Yeah, I'm okay," Jack replied. "Call in and get back up down here."